Welcome to the Sound of Chicago Jazz podcast series at the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. In this three-part series, we're discussing the influence of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians and looking in a little more detail at some of the musicians who developed their musical practice either through participation in that organization or inspired and influenced by its practices. Hosts for the Sound of Chicago Jazz podcast are me, Douglas Cowie, and Kara Rusch. I'm a writer and teacher.
And I've had a lifelong involvement with music, in particular jazz.
In this third episode, we're going to look at the legacy of the AACM, both within and outside the organization. In addition, we'll talk about the importance of Delmark Records, and we're going to discuss recent recordings by Angel Bat-David, Nicole Mitchell, and Cahil El-Zabar, who we also discussed in episode two. So I guess the first thing to do is to talk about, this is kind of almost like after two episodes of talking about the Art Ensemble of Chicago and the AACM, Cahil El-Zabar, Anthony Braxton, all these artists, we're now going to finally tell people why we're talking about them, in case you were wondering. I've pulled some quotations from some books that I hope will kind of set out a little bit of a story that will help us kind of go back to the first episode and think about some of that and bring us up to date and talk about why in my and maybe your, so our opinion, the AACM and the way they make music and the music that they make is so important. And so to start that, I'm just going to read a short paragraph from Paul Steinbeck's book, Message to Our Folks, about the Art Ensemble of Chicago. And in this paragraph, he just says, "The Art Ensemble's distinctive model of social relations, adapted from the AACM, made all these accomplishments possible. Although AACM musicians composed and performed in many different styles, they were bound together by a shared commitment to supporting one another's creative explorations. Drawing on the association's example, the members of the Art Ensemble established their own social model based on the principles of cooperation and personal autonomy. As George E. Lewis wrote in his AACM History, A Power Stronger Than Itself, the Art Ensemble of Chicago radically exemplified the collective conception of the AACM as a whole." So now I'm going to turn to George Lewis, who was quoted at the end of that. And he says something very interesting towards the end of his very long book on the AACM. It's a terrific book, A Power Stronger Than Itself. And he says this, again, another short paragraph, kind of summing up or taking stock of the AACM. He says, "Ultimately, the reasons why the AACM has become integral to the cultural identity of Chicago are relatively prosaic and can be enumerated at greater or lesser length. The deeper and more challenging question of why, despite the AACM's international cross-generational multi-genre purview, the crucible of Chicago continues to be integral to the AACM identity can only be hinted at in a narrative such as this one." I think that's a really interesting, despite being like four sentences, a really interesting paragraph. It's like, well, it's pretty like straightforward. Like these guys were all in Chicago making this music, and they had a way of doing it that was inviting to people. But why Chicago continues to carry this legacy is a really quite complicated question. And I guess part of our job in this podcast is to hint at some answers to that. And I'm going to start doing that by quoting another paragraph from yet another book. And this isn't a book about jazz. This is a book called Yore Was Stupid, Cranky Chicago and the Reinvention of Indie Music. It's by Bruce Adams, who's one of the co-founders of Cranky Records, which may or may not be known to our listeners. It's a very small label, but a very influential one in particular types of experimental rock music. And in the very first paragraph of his book, outside of the introduction, I'm going to read the whole first paragraph. This is what Bruce Adams says. The chapter is called Hey Chicago. He says, "The story of Cranky is a Chicago story. In the early 80s, as a global music underground was developing, a network of wholesale music distributors, independent record labels, clubs, recording studios, college radio stations, and DIY publications established themselves in Chicago. The city had been a center of the recorded music business since 1913, when the Brunswick Company started making phonograph machines and pressing vinyl. Chicago had been home to jazz pioneers Jelly Roll Morton, King Oliver, and Louis Armstrong for a brief, impactful time. In the 1950s, Chess Records was a force in the blues and R&B scenes. Alligator Records was an independent blues label started in 1971. But the founding of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, or AACM, in 1965 is what created the precedent and working model for independent organization and avant-garde music in the city that eventually was reflected in house music and underground rock. AACM's self-reliance and the border-crossing devotion of related musicians who incorporated ancient African music into the creation of future-facing music put Chicago on the map of innovative and independent music centers." I think this is such a great paragraph because it gives you this, like, a really short time, a history of Chicago music. It leaves out Delmark, which I will never forgive Bruce Adams for doing, but we're filling in that gap. But he gives you this short little history of jazz music in particular, its kind of relations to R&B, and then says, like, the AACM is the thing for these, even for these rock musicians, that shows you a way of doing your thing, of working across different genres of music and making something happen for yourself, that idea of self-reliance, which I think is just the crucial thing for all of this, the kind of self-reliance and open-mindedness, always looking to the future while using an understanding of all the history and culture that's come before you, is really the kind of, that's the key to this complicated thing that George Lewis is hinting at in that paragraph. And I mean, I feel like I've been talking already for a long time, and I want to let you say something, Kara, but I could sketch out even just briefly, like, the fact that these guys making rock music, and okay, they're skewing towards the kind of what we now call sort of post-rock or whatever, avant-garde rock, are picking up on this and bringing jazz and rock together and reinventing for their own purposes these models that other people have created and proven has worked is like a really key thing for me. And we're going to start talking about some of these musicians as we move on through this podcast, because I want to mention a few things, like the sort of 1990s landscape that Bruce Adams is talking about in his book is really about people like, or bands like Tortoise, whose members were playing in all kinds of different groups. And Jeff Parker, one of the members of Tortoise, is going to come up on one of the recordings we talk about later, who's involved in lots of different jazz projects in Chicago and beyond. The saxophonist and bass clarinet, the reeds player, Jeff Vandermark comes up again and again and again.
Ken Vandermark.
Did I just say Jeff?
Yeah.
Ken Vandermark. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's why you're here. Tell me where I'm wrong. comes up again and again and again in that book. And then you have this fairly new record label that's been going strong in Chicago for almost 10 years now. International Anthem was founded in December 2014 by two guys, David Allen and Scotty McNeese. Again, coming out of the indie, they're more coming out of the indie rock scene. And this is a really interesting music label, mostly kind of jazz, avant-garde jazz skewing in Chicago. They've had a couple of showcases at the London Jazz Festival over the last few years and developed a huge and really diverse range of musicians, including Angel Bat David, who we're going to talk about later, Damon Locke and his Black Monument Ensemble. Jamie Branch, the late Jamie Branch, has recorded for the trumpet player, amazing trumpet player, has recorded a lot of stuff released on International Anthem. And Jeff Parker, who I mentioned already, he played in Tortoise, but he's recorded under his own name as a solo project for International Anthem. He's also recorded with the Black Earth Ensemble, which we're going to talk about when we talk about Nicole Mitchell later. So there's like, I'm just trying to unpick a little bit here, just through a few little names, mm-hmm. all the directions in which that influence of the AACM, not all these people were in it. In fact, most of the ones I've mentioned were not.
Right.
But how that influence has just permeated the music scene of a city is really fascinating to me.
Well, one of the big things I noticed between when we were talking about setting up, like what defines the Chicago scene as opposed to, let's say, New York or LA or something, it almost feels to me like a story of the underdog in a way. And there's so much freedom in being the underdog. So when I think of New York scene, like post Mingus and East Coasting and all that, that very classic jazz that we're familiar with, for me, the downtown music scene coming out of the 80s and the 90s was very, it was tight and very, the thing about the Chicago scene I notice is it feels much more organic to me, and it seems like the boundaries are a lot looser, but that's not to say it's not purposeful. It's just not self-conscious in a way that I think of maybe other areas that have to adhere to this sort of sound, right? So even when the AACM started out, I think one of the sort of MOs was we're going to create our own music. But I've noticed even in when we talk about the new Cahill, the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, they do incorporate Creator has a master plan in the tradition, yeah. and even the pop tradition with some of the Bee Gees stuff that they do. So they've obviously relented on that, and maybe that not adhere. So starting out with we're going to establish this, but then we have the freedom to go in other places and see what we can do with it. So that's one of the big things I've noticed in listening to all this music is the genre is not so much important. So, well, we'll get to that with about the Nicole Mitchell record, which just incorporates so much into it. It's not so finite feeling to me. It's organic, but it's not, even in the way the music comes out, it seems very mantra-like, but not new age, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I wonder if some of that is also, it's the product to some degree of that principle of self-reliance. Like if we're going to do this ourselves, yeah. we don't have to, you know, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this without trying to sound like I'm being snotty about certain musicians that I don't intend to be snotty about. But like, if you're self-reliant, you can pursue your musical interest in the way that you want to. Whether that self-reliance is I'm going to make all my money from playing music and I have to live my life this way. We talked about this with Anthony Braxton last time as well. Or mm-hmm. whether you get a day job that allows you to like then pursue the musical avenues you want to because the bills are being paid elsewhere. But if you're like, whereas if you're like someone like Wynton Marsalis mm-hmm. who decides like I'm gonna be a super professional jazz and classical musician, and that means taking money from these places. I'm not self-reliant in that same way, and I have to sometimes record the albums, or I have to create, you know, the jazz at the Lincoln Center according to how the money and the people behind the money formulate that. You don't have to do that if you're booking your own venue and selling your own tickets, so to speak.
Right, sort of right. So and ethos. Also, so right. So there's freedom, and you can maybe, if you're supporting yourself by other ways, but I also think there's freedom once you're told you can't join a club.
Yeah.
There's a lot of freedom. And we've seen that in other areas, whether it's the gay community, where it's like, okay, we don't have to adhere to these rules. So we're going to make our own rules. And I think there is that creates, I mean, that can bloom into this other thing, which is just out of this organic process that just comes about. And I do see that about Chicago. I mean, people talk about jazz, they talk about New Orleans, they talk about New York City, they talk about Kansas even, you know. It's, mm-hmm. and it's not that they're not talking about Chicago. It's just, I think with the advent of the AACM, that's when it sort of started the basis of this is what we do. And it's just a different set, you know, it's not. And one of the big principles for me is it doesn't necessarily have to adhere to a race value, a gender value, a genre value. It's but it has to come from a sense of being purposeful, I think.
Yeah.
Because this otherwise way I don't of, think it's...
Yeah, this way of making music or making noise, making sound,
yes,
has a purpose to me. And if I keep doing it, I'll eventually find the other people who see things right. in a similar right. way, and then we can just do it together, and whatever happens, happens. What's really incredible to me, and I guess this is also part of what George Lewis is hinting at in that second quotation I read out, is that like this is a remarkably sustainable way of making music. Like there's still people yeah. doing this. Some of those original people are still doing it. People who were never in the organization have seen how they do it and said, yes, we can do our thing that way. And you're like, International Anthem is cranking out records like there's mm-hmm. no tomorrow, and doing so really successfully. I mean, not like they're making themselves millionaires, but they're making a culture by the willingness to release this stuff and the openness to say, hey, come, we've got the means to do this, come record for us. That's really exciting and makes, as we're going to talk about when we start talking about some of these recordings, like just makes exciting things happen. In fact, it has an influence. I feel like I should say this because I'm, you know, recording this from London where I live. And, you know, I think there's been an influence of that on the London jazz scene as well, maybe less directly because, you know, they're not sitting on the side of Lake Michigan where hovered around the Thames, but like there's this vibrant jazz scene in London over the last 10-15 years that is also often based on this kind of attitude, this collective attitude. So the Mercury Prize, which is a really big music prize in the UK, was just won by a jazz group called the Ezra Collective, who started out playing together in youth clubs and stuff and said like, oh, we like doing this way, and they kept doing it together, and they had that same kind of collective mindset. And you know, and it's that they're the, you know, they're the prize winners of the moment. But there's mm-hmm. there's a musician called Shabaka Hutchings who's similarly, I would say, musically to some of these musicians we've talked about, where he's doing lots of jazz and lots of classical, and never really necessarily seeing huge distinction between this, you know, these different ways of doing things, but beyond that. You know, they have certain different physical and emotional demands, but they're still all part of a broad mindset of music making and bringing people together to make music. And that's those are just a couple of examples of what's going on in London that I think bear some of those traces of Chicago and the AACM as well. I find that very exciting as just like a principle.
I definitely think breaking down the barriers has been, I do see that a lot, especially in the last 10 years. I see, even hear it on college radio, where you'll get the student DJs and they might play a Coltrane track next to a, you know, some, whatever the pop flavor of the day is. It doesn't, and sometimes I'm like, there's no mention of it. So I wonder, well, because I don't necessarily always draw the connection. And apparently the connection sometimes is just like, I like both of these things, but there's yeah. no need to explain it or say anything. I don't know. It could be total cluelessness. It doesn't really matter. In the end of the day, it's a new way of listening to things in relation to other things, and not saying, well, this is all, we're going to listen to classical, we're going to listen to 20th century classical, and we're going to listen to this,
yeah.
you know. So I find it refreshing, but contextualizing sometimes is cool too, because it gives you an idea that they're
yeah.
well, that's one of the things I'm impressed with, all the people who are very aware how much the AACM comes up just in music discussions.
Yeah,
just in thinking about this podcast that we've been putting together, these three things, how much just on the day-to-day things that I'll come across something and they'll have some connection to it. And maybe it's always been that way and I just didn't notice it as much because I wasn't being prepared to talk about it or anything and stuff, but that's a very nice, good thing to see, that it seems relevant and yeah. still relevant, you know?
Yeah. And is also, it's probably worth saying at this point, still a very much a live going organization.
Absolutely.
having mentioned International Anthem about a million times, I'm not being paid to do that. I just really think what they do is interesting. I want to go back a little bit. We mentioned it in the introduction, the role of Delmark Records, which is a Chicago-based record label, who also released one of the albums we're going to talk about later. But I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the role of Delmark in all of this as well, because I think some of the longevity is also related to the fact of recording.
Okay, so Delmark Records was started by Bob Kester. I'm pretty sure his wife, Susan Kester, or Sue Kester, as she's known, was also very instrumental behind the scenes, so I would be remiss if I did not mention her. She is still alive. He died in 2021, I think. He's from Kansas. He's from Wichita, and I think he's one of these classic stories. At a young age, he had polio. He spent a lot of time, in a bed, basically listening to the radio. And of course, in those days, he was born in 1932. So he was listening to probably a lot of territory bands that came through in the Midwest and loved them. And then, so then he moves to Chicago at some point. And in 1953, he starts Delmark, which was known as Delmar Records, and then eventually changed it to Delmark. I'm assuming he had the K for Kester, but he got sued by Selmar, which, who's talking about Selmar Records these days? So
they were a typo away from
exactly. and he basically, his whole, and this comes with that freedom, he just started putting out stuff that he liked. So if you look at their label, they have a very traditional jazz sense, and they have the blues. So, of course, Chess Records at the time was also very active and established that sort of Chicago sound. And it's a very tight, I'm not saying limited, it's great, great blues. It's very classic. It's what, when we think of American blues, what we tend to think of. But then Delmark picked up some other local people that weren't necessarily, some of it overlapped, like maybe Sleepy John Estes and people like
Junior Wells,
Otis Rush, Junior Mance, yeah. Buddy Guy. So there's some overlap in there. Otis Spann, I don't remember exactly everybody on the Chess roster, but anyway. And then in like 1966, this guy Chuck Nessa, who also had a record label called Nessa Records, encouraged Bob Kester to start recording the AACM guys. And Roscoe Mitchell was the first person, the musician that they recorded with that record called Sound. And he was also recording Mewhall Richard Abrams. And we talked about this at the beginning in the first podcast, I think, some of these musicians. And then he went on to record Sun Ra. So he has the traditional jazz, the blues, and then they have this avant-garde section. There's not a lot in the sort of hard bop or just jazz area. There is some, but not a ton. And then later they started reissuing other labels like Apollo and Sackville. But I think the essence of Delmark is just picking up what he liked, and they definitely in the Chicago area, because they eventually made their own recording studio and they were doing everything in-house. So I just, to give listeners a kind of a pointing direction and stuff, first of all, Delmark was very good at doing their own compilations. They had such a massive catalog, so they would have compilations, sets of compilations. And a lot of the stuff that I truly love, I just would put on one of these compilations and just see what caught my ear, because in theory, you have someone going through it and taking the best off of things and putting a track on there. So here's some things I just like to point people to really, really quickly. Jimmy Forrest, 1951, Night Train, that track. I mean, the whole record's called Night Train, I believe. The blues piece that stopped me cold in my tracks, which for me just put Delmark on the map for me, was a 1994 released by Jimmy Lee Robinson, and it's the title track, Lonely Traveler. I remember I was, working at Cadence and just, doing whatever I was doing there. And this came on and I actually just stopped what I was doing. And I said, I have to know what this is. So that's that for me. Another one is Roosevelt Sykes. I Like What You Do. It's off of Hard Driving Blues. The Sunrise Sound of Joy record is exactly as marketed. Sound of Joy, just great record. And then as far as the compilations, the Honkers and Bar Walkers compilation, the first volume is super fine. That's got that, just a lot of that big tenor sounds. It, again, Honkers and Bar Walkers, it just, you can visualize the whole thing listening to this. It opens with the Jimmy Forrest Night Train. And then one record which, you know, I'll just give a shout out to this guy, Frank Walton. He's a trumpet player. This is only like one of two records he ever made in 1978. It's kind of a strange record, but it does point to this whole aesthetic of just being open. It's a record called Reality. And I like this track called Waltz of the Prophets and then Change of Mode. But when I go back and listen to the record, some of it sounds 70s dated a little bit. But what I appreciate about Henry Threadgill's on that record, I believe. What I appreciate about the record is it just sounds like someone doing what they want to do. And again, in a very purposeful way, but not like, okay, now I'm going to make a record that is only this. And I think most listeners, if you've made your way to Del Mar Records, you're probably sophisticated enough as a listener to not need the parameters that maybe other more commercial records set to sort of house it. So that's my Del Mar Records, hugely important. It's still, even though Bob Kester died, I believe his son took over the label. But they've had, you know, over the years, like in an interview, Bob Kester says something about not really understanding the avant-garde. But then somehow they have a whole avant-garde
section.
But then
like, they have this huge catalog of some of the best avant-garde records ever recorded.
Exactly.
You don't have to understand it. You just got to listen.
Well, and the other thing I think is I think his ego was probably in check. And I think he probably had other people make suggestions to him, just like Chuck Nessa made a suggestion to him in 1966. He seemed very open to educating himself. He's obviously, if you spend a couple years convalescing and listening to music, that you have time to sit and listen to it. And as you know, things can sound strange to the ear. And then 2 weeks later, you listen to the same thing and it all makes sense.
It's like blows your mind, yeah. Well, that thing about having your ego in check seems like an important aspect of the ACM in general as well. That like, we're all here to do something collectively. And yes, we're all individuals and we can pursue our individual purposes and paths. But if we're going to do this together, there's got to be an ego check that allows us to listen to each other, listen to what we're doing, and pursue a direction that we're all traveling in together. And that it's not just a musical thing. It becomes a kind of lesson about how to produce, you know, how to produce the music, how to the people who are interested in recording it, but also like a kind of way of living your life if this is what you want to do as well. It's I mean, all I keep saying is like,
right,
it's really exciting, but I think they are good principles for
right. And I hadn't really thought of it that way. It's like they're individuals, but they're team players. So I remember years ago in, you know, high school sports for track or something, I had a coach say to the whole team, he's like, you guys are going to vote on this. Are we going for individual performance or team? So you have to rank it first and second. And so at the end of the day, he says, you've all voted for a team. That doesn't mean you can't be an individual on the team, but the team comes first. And I do think that the principles of the AACM definitely have this sort of, I wouldn't say it's tribe in the sense that there, again, there's freedom within there, but it's kind of like, it's very centric towards this is purposeful in this way. And but not in an ego way, more in an underdog way. So I kind of like that. And it does, I feel like it does come through in the music, you know?
For sure. So let's maybe use that as our smooth transition to talking about the music. We've got three albums that we're going to talk about, and I'll maybe just lay them out like as an overview, and then we'll talk about them as we go. So the first one is 2007, Nicole Mitchell's Black Earth Ensemble. The album is called Black Unstoppable. We're also going to talk about two 2023 albums. That was on Delmark, by the way. I should have said that. That's yes. Part of our transition. we're going to talk about Angel Butt Dawid's album, Requiem for Jazz, which came out 2023. That's on International Anthem. And then we're going to return to one of the subjects of the last episode, Kahil El-Zabar's Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, an album that was put out on the Spirit Muse label. It's called Spirit Gatherer, Tribute to Don Cherry. That's a 2023 album. And mm-hmm. there's like lots of different and overlapping things to talk about these three albums. But let's start with Nicole Mitchell, who is an important figure for us, not just because this album's good. It's a little bit of a while ago, 2007. She's by no means finished making music at all. Nicole Mitchell co-founded the first all-female ensemble within the structures of the AACM, Samana, with Maya and Shanta Nurala. So it was a trio. That was in the 1990s. I can't remember exactly which year. She was also the first female president of the AACM, which is important. She's no longer the president, but she was the first woman to be president of the AACM. So she's a key figure, right?
Absolutely. She just got over tenure there. So she's been on over like 60 recordings, about 20 under her own name. She seems, she's definitely very impressive, even forming some of her own labels, some of the way the labels are presented, the artwork, everything. She's very attentive to all those details. First of all, we should say she plays flute, several different flutes. So she's a flautist.
Amazing flautist.
Yes, yeah. So her style, so I was thinking about this because I like to think, yeah. I've always liked like a mean flute in jazz, like in the sort of Russ Sandrone Kirk or the Eric Dolphy vein. And she's got her own thing going, but she's definitely not worried about sounding pretty or not pretty. It's just like, again, it just seems to come from a place of this is what it calls for. And it doesn't seem overly self-conscious to me, her music at all. And in fact, in this record, you know, I've just had it on play for a few days, and the track about midway through the record, you have Sun Cycles, The Creator Has Other Plans for Me, and Life Wants You to Love. And if you just listen to those back to back, they could be from three independent albums, although they don't sound random. Again, the other thing I've noticed about a lot of this music is as a whole, so you have these parts, they're all one-offs, but as a whole, there definitely is a journey that they all take you on. It's not five tracks of the same thing. It's you start here, you meander here, maybe tighter the meander. So, you know, she's still recording. So she started recording like around 2000. You know, she does a lot of work on this label, also Rogue label. It's in France. And she's done duets with Joao Leandre, who plays bass, a very avant-garde player. It's very impressive. Her range, that Nicole Mitchell's range, is very, very impressive of what she does. And
she's also a composer and,
she also
and,
teaches.
A, and a professor,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
She's a professor. So she just got done with a tenure in Pittsburgh, I think. And now she's over in Virginia, as well as just getting done with being the head of the AACM. So very, very accomplished.
I want to talk about a little bit more about this album because I'm interested in also, like you, one of the things that really interests and I think maybe the word is beguiles me about this album and probably all the albums that we're talking about today is the way that you said they meander from thing to thing but never sound like they're meandering. They're always like, there's a lot of purpose to it. But like, I also want to talk about the name of the ensemble, the Black Earth Ensemble. Mm-hmm. This is also something you start to, you know, just like the kind of cultural impetus and purpose behind the AACMs, like the Art Ensemble of Chicago, the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, the Black Earth Ensemble. There's a real point of calling the thing an ensemble, of like the way in which that ensemble is named and the kind of the impetus behind that is. It's just worth noting. I don't have anything like super profound to say about it, but I think it's worth noting. The way that reflects in the music, I think is interesting.
So I think what they do is they both, it's the music that fits the project,
yeah,
or the project exactly. that fits the ensemble, and not necessarily the people, right?
Yeah, so this that's other, the sense this I other, got. If I'm going to go in this direction with my music, I'm mm-hmm. going to do it under a different title, a different name. I might, you know,
right.
Yeah. In fact, this ensemble features, I mentioned him a couple times, really Jeff Parker on guitar, and actually the guitar playing on this album is really great. I think all the playing's great, but it's interesting to hear guitar in that mix of voices. There's a couple of vocal tracks by Yagochi Mwagujguj, a Chicago singer. There's piano by Justin Dillard. David Young does some singing on it. It's an interesting ensemble. There's other players as well who I haven't gone into, but and then Nicole Mitchell, obviously playing flute. I should have.
Oh,
mentioned.
We should mention Tamika Reed because
oh, the cellist.
She's also yeah. yes, yeah, yeah, very good player. Yeah.
One of the things that also I've been thinking about is like we spent a lot of time talking about how they're all playing the art ensemble of Chicago in that first episode. They're all switching instruments and everything. Here, the players are playing instruments. There's less switching around. They're not just picking stuff up as you know in what you think of as the sort of Grateful Dead desk way of doing things with the art ensemble. There's a little bit more. It's a bit tighter construction and composition here, I suppose, but. This album, this performance is really exciting because it moves from like those vocal tracks where you get, sometimes it really sounds like soul. Sometimes it mm-hmm. it shifts into something else. You get these really like rhythmic African rhythms kind of always emerging out and locking in. And that's a bit more maybe something in line with the ethnic heritage ensemble that where that pulsing rhythm is always so much a part of what Kahil El-Zabar mm-hmm. is up to. But then it shifts out of these things into more, I don't want to say abstract, but less rhythmically shaped sections. And it's sometimes it swings.
That's the thing is those three tracks I picked out. Well, yeah. Sun Cycles is more ethereal sounding, but it totally swings. And there's a place where they just get in it goes from like this R&B soul thing to just a straight up blues. But one of the things I notice is unlike really commercially produced music, so there might be a mantra that's threaded through, like the creator has a master plan, let's say, not on this in particular, but where there's this mantra threaded through, but it's not set up in the traditional way where like there's a chorus and then you come back and you have a new verse and then you come back to the chorus. You just kind of, the mantra is the steady, but then it goes to all these other places and comes yeah. back at some point, you know?
And that's even more at play in the Angel Bat Dawid recording, Requiem for Jazz, which maybe we just use that as a transition. We can sure. always come back and talk about all these things together. But so Angel Bat Dawid is a really interesting musician. She's a clarinetist primarily. She plays some other instruments. She sings. She's also a teacher. She teaches a course. This is really interesting. The Old Town School of Folk Music, which is a important Chicago music institution that lies a bit outside of our remit for this program, but I'm sponsored a course that she taught in a young offenders prison on great Black music, which we talked mm-hmm. about at length in the first and at the beginning of the second episodes. And so like, I think that's indicative of maybe where Angel Bat Dawid is coming from. Again, this album was released on International Anthem. It was commissioned for the Hyde Park Jazz Festival in 2019. But this is something that she says. This is from an interview I found on National Public Radio with Ira Glass. This is just a short quotation from her. She says, "It was Mozart's clarinet concerto that made me really want to play the clarinet. Being in Chicago, being around musicians that were experimenting, especially Black musicians, they explored freeness. Being around them, going to jam sessions in the city, I learned how to do that too. It was the perfect blend, like the extra sauce I needed in my musicianship because I was missing something. That's why things didn't pop off for me earlier in my life, in my music career, because I was missing that key element. But that key element had to come at a specific time, space, and place in order for it to be right. There's a lot of patience that you have to have as a musician." There's a lot in there, but I think it also speaks to this particular recording where it's a requiem for jazz, and it's organized in that, like, you know, in classical music, you get these various requiems, and right. she's organized this in a similar way, but hopping around from genre to genre like it's the most natural thing on earth. And she uses these kinds of what you've called mantras. He's like, there's these like single lines that are running in and out all the way across this thing, and they're changing, and they're all very highly charged lines a lot of the time. They're defiant, they're provocative, and they come in sometimes sounding like a field holler. Sometimes they sound like gospel. Yeah. Sometimes they sound like soul. They go into like avant-garde, like kind of electronic music. They go into, you know, jazz. They're very high classical at times. And like, it's amazing to me that this album coheres whatsoever. And it really does. It's such a thrilling album to me.
It does. There's a ton of tracks on this. There's like, I think 26 tracks or 24 tracks, somewhere in there. And the shortest ones are like under a minute, and the longest one is a little bit over 5 minutes and stuff. And it really does, it'd be hard to pick out. I didn't do this, perhaps I should have just picked out one as a one-off to see how it sounded. But the whole, when you give yourself over to listen to the entire piece of work, it makes conceptual sense. It makes I don't know much about her. In fact, it wasn't until you brought this to my attention that it was on my radar. I'd seen the name.
This is a great victory for me in my life, by the way, introducing you to a musician.
Well, what I like to do is when I listen to something is to not read about it, to just see what I get a sense of it. And so one of the things, so I'm just kind of yesterday, like, or a couple of days ago, spouting like, okay, so it's got this kind of religious component, and it's got this very classical component, and it's got very current music aesthetics in the, in like, I wouldn't say rap, but in the, you know, like the urban music that.
There's like all these electronic beats that come in and some.
Yeah. Like.
Yeah.
Right. And so. And there were parts where it was extremely theatrical to me. What I felt when I came, it was like someone is laying claim to being able to be part of a conversation, especially in the European classical mode. And since there has been so much erasure in the Black community when it comes to what we assume, all this other stuff we put into the classical realm and how it has to be. It's kind of like, yep, I don't give a crap. I'm doing this. And this is my way of doing it. And I think that's why it does sound fresh, but like most things, having a foot in the past sort of is, to me, it's not, makes it less random. It's like, it also points to, this is what I'm doing with this. I always like it when albums have a standard or something we're familiar with, along with a fresh body of work, because then I can appreciate what they're bringing in their own compositions, because I have nothing to think in relation to that. Not that you have
like,
to.
They're saying like, this is the conversation I'm having.
Yes. And it shows their level of creativity or lack thereof, if that's the case too. Right. So I just think it helps contextualize what it is. So yeah, I kind of came away after a couple listens and just like kind of not confused, riveted. Not sure how much I would go back to it all the time, but I think these things take, when it's a lot to digest, let's put it that way.
I mean, it was also, it was conceived as a performance, right? And the recording is a recording of the performance. And so a part of what I was doing listening to it was thinking like, what would it have been like to be sitting in the audience at this thing? Because it's really demanding music. In a way that, like, I think the Nicole Mitchell album, the Black Earth Ensemble, is a bit more inviting. It kind of lets you in and brings you along. And Angel Butt DeWeed is kind of trying to sometimes push you out. Sometimes she's trying to confront you. And sometimes she's trying to bring you back in. And she does that in really interesting ways musically, with the words that she sings.
The text
and speaks.
Is very,
yeah. And what the other thing is that I think links these two albums, possibly one of the main things in my mind is Sun Ra, who we've only ever mentioned fleetingly all the way through here, and is another, you know, Chicago. He's not really a Chicago musician in the sense that he's spent his life there, because he ended up in, you know, New York and then Philadelphia, which is really where he's most associated. But his first recordings were made by, or some of his first recordings were made by Delmark, you mentioned earlier.
Absolutely.
And who's like, whose attitude towards these things, I think, just permeates a lot of what a lot of this musicians like the ones we've been talking about. Angel Bat-David mentions him explicitly towards the end of the album.
She does. And even on the Nicole Mitchell, the Sun Cycle song, I mean, she also, Nicole Mitchell, does this whole, that avant-garde record with Joao Leandre called Sisters mm-hmm. from Where, and it's all about the planets and Saturn. And I'm not saying Sun Ra is the only one who claimed the planets, but it's definitely there. You know, I think he is just informed so much in not only his music, but his presentation yeah. and his openness. And I think I might have mentioned before, I would argue that Lady Gaga and her, you know, her whole, like, not showing her, like, all of her stuff was directly informed from Sun Ra, but he's out there. He's, you know.
Yeah. Well, also he's like, when you listen to the orchestra and, like, no matter where they go, you know, at any moment they might all lock in and just start swinging away, which yeah, is like one of the yeah. things that the Black Earth Ensemble Nicole Mitchell album does quite a lot. It just keeps doing that, and I love it.
Right.
It's like, it's almost like there's this like spirit of Sun Ra just sort of hanging yeah. in the room while you're listening yeah. to it. Not in a derivative or boring way at all.
Not
but just
a,
like
no.
that there's this like this possibility, and Angel Bat-David is doing it because there's this. I don't want to call it ideological purpose, but there's this kind of political purpose behind that particular mm-hmm. piece of music, Requiem for Jazz, which I think people, it's better to let people kind of approach it by listening to it. But like, she's talking about the place of jazz in American culture, in Black American mm-hmm. history, in white American history, the, I would say, not always comfortable meeting places of those. And it's really powerful, but like, again, like the excitement of how she tells that story musically and verbally is really worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to say about that album in particular, because I kind of want to turn to Kahil El-Zabar one more time, because I think that this most recent album by the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, Tribute to Don Cherry, mm-hmm. kind of pulls together something important that you mentioned earlier, which is about, you said, oh, I like an album where there's a standard or whatever that then sits there as a kind of like a anchor point or a folk, like a
yeah.
reference point to this other stuff. And this album is a very interesting one in that respect. Just to remind listeners, Kahil El-Zabar is also a former president of the AACM. This album was recorded as a tribute to the trumpet player Don Cherry. Mm-hmm. It includes his late son mm-hmm. on it as well.
David Ornette Cherry.
Yeah, who died just after a performance of this, a tribute performance for Don Cherry in London yeah. last year. But this is an album that's doing all those kinds of things. It's paying tribute to a musician. It's doing it by interpreting some of his music. It's doing it with some original music. It's doing it by interpretations of other people's music. There's a great, I don't think there's any, like, I would just listen to almost any version of any Thelonious Monk song, because I think he's just one of the greatest composers ever. But like, there's a really nice Monk song on this album. And again, it's like this.
Well, you needn't.
Yeah. It's this thing of invoking a way of doing music by showing the cultural history behind it,
mm-hmm.
but never just imitating it, always taking it somewhere new. There's also some John Coltrane. They riff on A Love Supreme.
Love Supreme, yeah.
Which, when I saw them do this live in London in 2022, was really something. It was really exciting when the music suddenly turned into this, and you're just like, wow, you know, it was really exciting.
Yeah. 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 Those two tracks for sure. And then I want to mention too, that I think I had seen Ethnic Heritage Ensemble right before maybe you did in 2022. And it was Cahill and Corey Wilkes on trumpet and Alex Harding on baritone. And Cahill mentioned during, you know, the in-between chatter that they were making a record with Dwight Tribble. And I almost was like, do you have the tapes? I mean, like, you're not leaving. I want to hear the... And Dwight Tribble's one of these guys. I think he's based in California. And he's a vocalist very much in the Leon Thomas vein. However, there's only one Leon Thomas, and I think that so much of Leon Thomas was the fact that there wasn't a Leon Thomas before Leon Thomas, and that it's not, it's very
can
much
you just say a little bit about who Leon Thomas is for people who don't know?
So he was on, I think, the original Love Supreme, and he was on Impulse Records, and he's a kind of a yodeler, but not I mean, that's one of the things he does. I mean, he also just sings, and that very 70s kind of vibe, like Sunflower, like all these songs that we associate with that kind of fire music of Bob Dylan's Impulse, the avant side of Impulse and stuff. And it sounds, I love this stuff, but it sounds dated in the sense that it harkens to an era and a feeling of that time of the 70s and what was going on in black music. And the fact that in jazz, vocals up until, I mean, I can't even say for now, but most people, it's not like real jazz if there's vocal, you know, like this whole, what we were talking about, the kind of the ego and the aesthetic and how it has to be. And once you just say, you know what, screw it, I'm going to do what I want to do if I want to put a vocalist on the record. And also vocalists more conscious about presenting themselves as a sound and an instrument and not as a person in front of a band. I think there's a lot more. Jazz has been much better about incorporating vocalists in, and also just not sexualizing female vocalists. Like, there's this, it's a bigger issue that once it's all sorted out, we'll be able to look back at that and say, oh yeah, this is when they had the person out in the front of the microphone dressed this way, doing this type of thing, right? And now it's, you know, it's more, I'm making an artistic statement with or without words, with sounds and some, you know, and stuff. But anyway, so Leon Thomas is got this kind of very warble. I think he's got like his voice is very deep, like baritone-y, I would say. And just, it's like a warm towel. It's like, it just, when it just encompasses you. Like it just feels very, to me, exciting, sometimes soothing, but you're not going to be able to have a modern day Leon Thomas as Leon Thomas because it's such a sound. It's such a concentration. But Dwight Tribble is about, who definitely is, who has come out of that sound and does his own thing. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I don't love everything he does, but when he's on point, he is fantastic. And very ethereal, very spiritual. Yeah. And also for a while, I think, got into that sort of club scene too, where I was like, what a waste of his talent, but not, I mean, if you're going to listen to that, I guess why not have it be Dwight Tribble? But, so on this, he's on this record, it's pretty easy to discern between Cahill's vocals and Dwight's vocals. So I don't, you know, I think it, but if
there's a quality and robustness to his voice that is just kind of unmistakable.
Yeah. But if you want to just like check out a Dwight Tribble track issued under his name, I hesitate sometimes to do that because it might be one I'm like, yeah, I would never listen to that again. But when he's on, here's a track. It's with I think it's with the Gowanus Orchestra, and it's called Love Is Everywhere. And it's very Monterey. It's like a 5-piece EP or something. And it plays as a whole, and it's very, it's probably one of my favorites of him, but he's very good. So when I saw he was on this record, I was like, oh yeah. So he's not on every track though. Like they use him on some tracks, but not everything. And then the other thing we should mention
you definitely notice when his voice comes in on this album though. Like it's just like you can't, you can't miss his voice. It's so right.
And the other thing I want to note on this album is David Ornette Cherry is playing mm-hmm. piano, and you very rarely hear piano in Cahill's groups. I'm not saying you don't, but it's not. He's usually a very percussive sounds, woven into very percussive sound, because it makes sense. Cahill is a percussion mm-hmm. player. So anyway, so there's like one track, I think, with piano on this. And it's sort of it's very free and, fluid going in and out. So anyway, and Lonely Woman, their version of Lonely Woman, which was highly associated with Ornette Coleman, and the feel comes across, but it's a different instrumentation. And anyway.
Yeah. It's this album of again, like I said this already, but it's you're paying tribute to Don Cherry. It starts with this mantra, this song called Don Cherry, that's just using his name as a mantra. And it's a real, like, we talked about this kind of thing when we talked in the last episode about Cahill El-Zabar and Ethnic Heritage Ensemble. Like, this kind of repetition of these things is really, it's part of his modus operandi, I suppose, which I love. It's one of the things I really, really like. It's like, when you just keep repeating these things and you start to feel the textures of that repetition. It's taking some of these ideas and sounds that we've been talking about over the three episodes and filtering them or using them as a means of re-expressing Don Cherry's music, John Coltrane's music, Ornette Coleman's music, Thelonious Monk's music, the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble's music,
and their own music.
I guess that's
right.
Yeah. And that's the kind of, I guess that's the point to me ultimately of what is really exciting about this approach that we've been discussing over three podcast episodes. It's like, it's not directionless meandering around. It's like, we can use this to explore the world. This is a way of understanding the world musically through the things that we already know, whether it's the classical style of Angel Bat-David, those African rhythms of Nicole Mitchell and the Black Earth Ensemble, or like taking like a kind of moment of, or some moments of jazz history here and recombining them and re-expressing them that's just the tip of the iceberg. We talked at length about the politics of Angel Bat-David's album as well.
Right. The biggest thing I noticed with all of these, and maybe the AACM aesthetic in general, is the music is a continuum that harkens back to the ancestors, and that is very much present and alive. And that's, and even with some of the, when you were talking about the more indie rock groups or these other groups, everyone kind of knows who the AACM is in Chicago. Like, it's like they know there's an awareness that this is a thing and what the purpose of it is. And then you can do with it what you want. But I think these three records in general, they rely a lot on the ancestors that came before them. And like you said, it's not derivative, but it's conscious that there's a platform there. But then it's a continuum. And that's a great thing about music in general, is you can go back on any given day and go back and forth, whether the people are currently alive it's a conversation that can happen in many different ways, even, just through listening, which is fantastic.
Yeah. And leads you into a different future, which these artists are already conscious of as well. Mm-hmm. We're gonna have lists of all the material that we've drawn on the books and interviews that we've used, and also some of the music that we've talked about. We're gonna have lists of all that in the show notes. So if people are sick of listening to us talk, they can turn it off and go and listen. I say at the end of three episodes, they can go and listen to the stuff that we're talking about. And I hope people will. And I hope people will who haven't yet heard some of this music will be really excited to pay attention. So thank you everyone for listening. And thank you, Kara, for putting together this series.
Thank you for making it happen. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the American Central. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.